Hi, food fans. Alton Brown here. This is the Alton Brown cast. We've got a pretty good show today. Of course, I always say that. I realize that we always have a pretty good show. But today we're going to be dealing with some spicy issues. And no, I don't mean anything, you know, spicy that way. I mean spicy like spice rack. We are going to be talking to Tom and Patty Erd. Now, you probably don't know these people, but they run a very fine operation up in Evanston, Illinois, called the Spice House, which is where I get all of my spices. And they also make some specialized spice mixtures for me that can be procured out in the world through means that, well, I won't get into that right now. It doesn't matter. So we're going to be talking to them, and they're going to have some very revealing facts about spices, things that go on in the spice world, and how you can get more out of your spices. As always, we're going to be dealing with some of your calls and questions coming in through our email bag and through Twitter and whatnot. So stick around for the Alton Brown cast. It's only going to take about an hour. And hey, what would you do with an hour anyway if you weren't listening to this? Exactly. All right, let's take a listen to a few of your call-in questions.
Russ, are you with me?
Hi, how are you, sir?
Hey, where are you, Russ?
Central New Jersey.
So what do you have on your mind today?
Well, basically, I started cooking when I was very young, and then I came across the Food Network, and I tried doing some things, you know, with some of the other cooks who were on at the same time that you guys started out, and they were a little too difficult. Found your show, started cooking a lot more. It was a lot more understandable. Learned a lot from you through the years, so I just want to say that, and I'm very appreciative of that.
You're very welcome,
started
sir.
Smoking after your episode with the smoker and the box and the fish. We smoke everything that'll stand still now. My question to you is, if there's any episode that you could go back and redo now that you've been doing this quite a while and, you know, your timeline of cooking has progressed, is there any episode you would go back and maybe rethink and redo and maybe change it all?
Yes.
Which one? Or which ones?
Season one, pasta.
Okay.
Pasta. I did things in that show that don't make any sense. I thought they made sense at the time because I was perpetuating a mythology that when in reality, I should have been attempting to disprove mythologies. For instance, I said in that show that I never cook, and this is it's like a quote, it haunts me. I never cook dried pasta unless I boil a gallon of water first. This is one of the stupidest things that I've ever said and is completely wrong. And scientifically unsound. I had unfortunately come out of a situation where I'd been trained by people who were very convincing, who had convinced me that that was needed. And then I just went out and tried to find science to support that when that was wrong. The truth is I have found now that dry pasta should always be started in cold water, not boiling water, and that it actually doesn't require very much water at all. You really only have to have enough water to cover it. You know, okay. Any shaped pasta like farfalle or anything like that, I just cover with cold, salty water, bring it to a boil, drop the heat, simmer 7 minutes, done. And when you look at the science of how starch actually hydrates and how it cooks, I would have, if I had bothered to do that properly the first time, I would never have said the things that I said. So if I could go back and redo one, that would be it. The second one would be our very first oatmeal show, because the truth is I've gotten to where I also never boil oatmeal. I start oatmeal in cold water and never allow it to go over a simmer, and I never stir it.
Oh.
I never, ever stir it. So these are both things that just years have taught me, you know, to challenge existing paradigms more and more. And I have found certainly that some of the rules that I supported were not the case.
All right. Well, I appreciate your time, sir. Look forward to seeing you on your tour.
Thank you very much. Enjoy the rest
Thank
of your
you.
Day up there in New Jersey.
All right. Bye-bye.
We're going to talk to Adam now. Are you there, Adam?
Yes, I am.
So what's your question for me tonight, sir? What do you want to talk about?
I guess, you know, a long time ago, my family was pretty well known for making glug, and the recipe got lost, and I'm trying to rediscover how to make glug, and I was wondering if you had any idea.
It's funny you mention this, because I make glug at Christmas time, you know, because it is essentially a mulled wine and is very popular during the holidays, and not everybody likes eggnog. Well, no, that's not true. I don't like everybody enough to give them my eggnog. So for the people I don't like, I'll give them glug. But the thing is that glug's got probably more alcohol in it than eggnog has in it, because of course, typically, you know, you've got vodka on top of wine. So that's pretty potent stuff. And I'm going to be honest, the recipe that I use was originated at Akavit, the fine Scandinavian restaurant, Marcus Samuelson's place in New York City. And you can get the recipe online. It's it was published by Sever magazine, the exact recipe that I use, which calls for, you know, red wine, port, vodka. It's got dried fruit in there. They use figs in theirs, which is the only one that I've seen that does that. Orange peel, sugar, star anise. They call for Balinese or Indonesian long pepper. You don't have to use that. You can use peppercorns. If you can get hold of long pepper from somebody like the Spice House there in Illinois, up in Evanston, Illinois,
then
it's a great ingredient, and I keep it around for use in things like, believe it or not, I use it in apple pies. No, wait, that's Grains of Paradise. That's different. Strike that. And then it's got cloves in it, cardamom, and cinnamon. So it's pretty spicy stuff. But, you know, the engine room on that is two bottles of red wine, some port, and vodka. So that's a party in a cup, by all means. But that's the one I use. And I've tried to improve it. I can't. I can't really improve it. I've replaced the oranges with orange liqueur, with triple sec or Grand Marnier, but it doesn't really make it any better. So give that one a try.
Do you make your own orange peels, your dried orange peels, or do you just...
Yeah, I do. I do. I do, because I think that the quality on it's better. I can't really get a very good dried, or for that matter, candied orange peel where I live. And I like candied very much. So I'll cut it up every year when the oranges are really great in the winter and just put it in a big old thing of sugar and let it sit there. So I'm more candy it than dry it, but you can try it if you want.
Right. All right. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Luckily, many of you continue to send your comments and questions to me at askalton@altonbrown.com, Facebook and Twitter. So let's dive in and answer a few of those. Here's a question via email from Laura Tobias, who says, what is the purpose of blanching vegetables? Anything other than keeping color and crunch? Well, I mean, that's a lot. I mean, color and crunch, especially color. You know, fruits and vegetables typically contain these chemical agents called enzymes, and they're there to act as catalysts, and they set certain changes into effect, into action, decomposition, but also ripening, color changes, things like that. And unlike bacteria, enzymes are impervious to cold. Okay, they can continue to do their thing in the refrigerator, but high heat shuts them down. So even a quick dip in boiling water can preserve, say, the green and broccoli, or a little bit of acid added to certain fruits like apples keeps browning from taking place. So although it's, you know, you can say that, you know, it's anything other than color and crunch, I would say color, yes, crunch in some cases. But you're also providing or shutting down the continuing of the decomposition process in some ways. So I tend to find that vegetables that are properly blanched and then shocked, meaning that you're going to very quickly drop them into boiling water and then into an ice water bath to stop that cooking process, that those foods will last a lot longer. And when I know that I'm going to be cooking a vegetable, very often when I come home from the grocery store, I'll just get a big pot of water going and I'll blanch a bunch of stuff. I mean, let's face it, raw broccoli. Okay, first off, nobody eats raw broccoli. Okay, you know, when they put them on those crudité platters, nobody eats that. I mean, when people do, I laugh at them because it's disgusting. It's horrible. Raw broccoli sucks. Okay, there, I've said it. Sorry, broccoli people. The thing is once you've blanched it, even quickly blanched it, not only do you preserve that green, preserve some of the crunch, preserve some of the nutrients, you're a lot closer to making it, you know, culinarily useful for other things. So I say go ahead and blanch stuff. I blanch everything from kale to certainly collard greens, Brussels sprouts, you name it, I'll blanch it. And the same is true if I cut up a bunch of fruit. I will usually add an acid to it. Sometimes it'll be citric acid. Sometimes it'll be actually the juice of lemon or lime, or vitamin C even. I've made a vitamin C dust out of just grinding up vitamin C tablets in a mortar and pestle or with a mortar and pestle and sprinkling over the food. So, there's an example of a few ways to make that work for you. Thanks for the question. Jonathan K gets in touch with a problem that I've encountered before, a dilemma rather. Jonathan says, can you store leftover waffle batter, or is it a one-time use batter? Okay, here's the thing. It does not freeze very, very well. Well, I mean, it freezes okay, but it doesn't work very well after it is frozen, because most of the, a lot of the gas has already been released from the baking powder that is typically in most waffle recipes. However, waffles freeze very well. So I would say go ahead and make the waffles, undercook them just a hair. And then let them cool on a rack, and then freeze those in zip top bags, one at a time if you can, or a couple, with a layer of parchment paper in between them. And here's a little trick. Here's what I do. Okay, I think this is ever so clever. When I do them, when I cook the waffle in my waffle iron, and I use I think mine's a Villaware waffle iron that I've had for years and years and years. I cut this little bitty notch out of the very bottom of the waffle, so that I know where it will line up in the waffle iron. That way, when I reheat it, I don't do it in a toaster or the toaster oven. I actually put it right back in the waffle iron. But I want to make sure that kind of goes right back in. So I do this little notch. That way, I know it'll snap right into place in the waffle iron. I'll be able to reheat it and get some nice crispness on the outside. So good question. Good luck with that. And by the way, when I reheat or retoast my waffles in my waffle iron, I just do them straight from the freezer. It doesn't seem to mind, but if you want to let them thaw, that's perfectly okay too. All right. Thanks everybody for sending in your culinary queries. Please keep them coming, and eventually we'll get to them. Sometimes the stack gets deep, but we'll get through it. So this is Alton Brown of the Alton Brown Cast, a recording today in Chicago, Illinois, which is why we have the Erds with us from the Spice House. Tom and Patty, can I call you Tom and Patty? You prefer I call you something else? So I haven't seen you guys in a few years.
14 years.
Is it actually 14
Isn't
years?
That amazing?
I came here and shot in 1999. Right. It
Correct.
Was winter, fall of 1999, buying spices for what became our fruitcake episode, which was in season two of Good Eats. So it's been a long time. Is the store changed a whole lot?
No, it hasn't changed a whole
still,
lot.
Still
got a couple more locations, but that's
a couple more
it.
Locations. But it's better to have more locations than a bigger store, I would think.
But we have 550 products, so it's difficult to go much larger in the spice world anyway.
In the time since then, and thank you, by the way, for being here on the cast. I've been wanting to get you guys on. At the time, I think that that we did that. Spices were still something that a lot of folks just didn't give a whole lot of thought to. Spices were things in the little tin on the shelf in the grocery store, and by and large tasted like dust. And if anybody did think of spices at all, it was, well, I guess back then it was cinnamon, maybe some cloves around mm-hmm. Christmas time, and pepper, black pepper. Pepper nigrum, and not a whole lot more.
Maybe paprika.
Yeah. But paprika was more a colorant than a flavorant at the time, because most people, I know people still to this day who have paprika in their cupboard that's been there for, you know, like 12 years. They actually inherited it from a dead relative. I mean, that's how bad it is. Oh, look, Tom whips out. Well, you've got how many different paprikas do you have there?
Wow.
We're actually in a hotel suite here in Chicago, high above Rush Street, but they have brought show and tell. We've got sticks and branches. We've got acacia and cinnamon. We've got
six different varieties of
paprika and several other little bags, one of which I didn't recognize, and they had to tell me what was, which really humiliated me in a lot of ways. Oh, and there's my own blend, the Alton Brown Fruit Transformation Blend, which I really like a lot. I put it on all sorts of things because you guys do make a blend for me, and I appreciate mm-hmm. that. Only I'm going to find a way to sell more of it. See what's
we
this
have
one.
Ideas about that.
Well, good. I'm glad you do, because somebody needs to have better ideas. Oh, here's the Mythic Meat Powder. I'm actually out of Mythic Meat Powder. So, how did it start?
Our business was started by my parents.
Okay, tell the tale, because most people don't know this.
So we started in 1957, and my parents basically sold coffees, teas, and spices. And as they got a little more financially secure, they bought grinders and sifters. And when we started grinding our own spices, the spice dust got everywhere. So people would start to say, you know, the smell in here, it's great, but I don't like it in my morning coffee or my morning tea. So they had to decide one path to go down, and they chose the path of spices. Perhaps if they would have chose coffee, we might have been Starbucks, but we're really excited about what we do after 56 years of doing it.
And how has the – now, people don't realize, I mean, the spice trade is – an extremely complex, a very, let's put it this way, there's a lot of history to the spice trade.
It's the second oldest profession in the world.
So they say. So they say. Whether we can prove that or not, I don't know. But, I mean, you can trace the whole history of the world basically by spices
you
and
can.
Man's desire to get them and obtain them and, above all, control them.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so we come, you know, in a world where, you know, during parts of the Middle Ages, you know, black pepper was worth its weight in gold, to a point in American history, certainly in the 60s when I was born, where nobody gave a rat's ass about them. Or if they did, they didn't care about the quality of them. How do you think we went from holding them in high esteem to treating them like dust? How did that happen? What do we do culturally to make that happen?
Well, historically, spices were far more than food flavorings. You know, right now we think of them to flavor our food. Centuries ago, spices were medicine. You know, the compounds in spices are extremely beneficial to us. There's still huge studies being done on cinnamon and the effects that it has on blood sugar and cholesterol levels. There's studies being done on ginger, on turmeric. And historically, people knew this. Doctors knew this back in, you know, 500 BC, they knew this. But you didn't have pharmaceutical companies, you had to eat the raw plants. So spices were far more than food flavorings. They were medicine. They were used as currency. You would count out peppercorns to pay your rent. They were used as aphrodisiacs. You know, people didn't always smell so good. So spices made us smell
good. A lot of people
good.
I know don't smell very good now.
You know, I mean, you know, people didn't have running water. People didn't have showers. So, you know, if you could make the room smell good, you can make yourself smell good, your romantic encounter had a lot more chance of success. And people did that with spices. So it was far more than just a food flavoring. And their value, therefore, was huge. You know, if we walked into a room with this much spices 500 years ago, you know, we'd get robbed.
Your question, though, is kind of a... It's kind of a complicated one, but I think firstly the world became a more global place, and when that happened, we wanted to have the authentic flavors used in global, you know, all the different cuisines of the world. 20 years ago, maybe you had Mexican and
Italian,
yeah,
Italian,
right.
Mexican, and
right.
Maybe occasionally Chinese.
Right. So then when we went global, we had to source ingredients, and of course spices, they don't grow in the United States; they come from all over the world. But then I think maybe now we're in sort of a quality obsession. So we're just obsessed with having the top quality beef and vegetables and knowing our farmer, and it's not quite translated to spices yet, but it's starting to. So when people think of cinnamon, I think part of that is because we don't have a frame of reference, because spices are not grown by our farmers here, because they can't be. So we don't have a frame of reference for what a good quality spice is, and we try, Tom and I, to educate people as to what that means. So cinnamon isn't just something that comes from the other side of the world. We're able to source cinnamon from four different locations, and each location, like grapes and terroir, each location produces a different flavor of cinnamon. It's all cinnamon, but we carry four very distinct varieties of cassia and true cinnamon.
So I'll back up for a second. You mentioned something that I think is important in having any conversation about ingredients, which is that we're becoming a culture of connoisseurs, or at least we'd like to think we are. And that, at least in my experience, there are a couple different phases of that. Americans are becoming very, very astute eaters, but we're not necessarily astute cooks still yet. And we still don't know how to use, in our culture, spices in cooking, the way that you would see, for instance, if you were to go into an Indian home, mm-hmm. our Middle Eastern home, and see that so many dishes begin with spices, begin with the toasting of spices, or certainly in a lot of Indian curries, the frying of whole spices. We don't start there. We still finish with them, by and large, or we add them in baking. But I know a lot of people that call themselves good cooks or believe that they are good cooks, certainly hobbyist cooks, mm-hmm. that still don't know how to work spices into a food unless they're following a recipe that says add half a teaspoon of a five spice or something like that. So we use them as cultural markers, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
Something that I see, you know, talking to people who watch Iron Chef America, of saying, you know, well, I want to use those spices that Chef blah, blah, blah uses in their food. And we use them as those kind of cultural touchstones, but we don't actually know how to use them properly. Now, you bring up cinnamon.
Mm-hmm.
Is this the most common spice in people's minds in America? If you say name a spice, they say cinnamon.
I'd say probably pepper.
Or pepper?
Yeah. By far pepper.
By far pepper. Okay, now, a decade ago, there was just black pepper, whole black pepper. Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned terroir and the idea of that, you know, depending on where you get it and how it's grown and all of those different factors, that it really does make a great deal of difference on spices. Is that something that you tell people about pepper?
We do. And there's also a lot of pepper grown in various places that we don't have access to because it's not commercially harvested. So, of course, that enters into our picture. But we have peppercorns from the Tellicherry coast of India.
Right. And which is probably the most famous black pepper area of the world, right?
So it's got a real rich sort of, it's vine ripe and fully vine ripe. It's got a rich, fruity flavor. But then we have a lampong pepper that's smaller and sharper and hotter. And we always encourage people to taste because taste is so subjective. So you taste the two peppercorns and see what you think.
So. Also, there's been an evolution in the U.S. too, a good one, where I know in my mother's generation, everybody bought ground pepper. And the ground pepper sat around until it was finished, maybe 3 months, 6 months in the house. And the problem with that is what gives pepper and all spices their flavor and their aroma are the volatile oils. And the volatile oils means it's reacting with air. It's volatile. It gets in your nose. That's what they do. So those volatile oils are all evaporated out of it in 3-4 days. Nowadays in America, everybody's got a pepper mill, which is what we're supposed to do. We're supposed to grind it fresh. We bust open the cell walls, you release the volatile oils, and the pepper's way better.
Right. You get the air, you get the aroma, you get the flavor.
Yeah.
Getting people to realize that... One of the things that I dealt with in the early days of my show was to get people to realize the difference between buying a ground spice and grinding their own, and even toasting and then grinding, and the difference in flavors and ultimately the difference in quality of the food.
But on the flip side, there's a couple spices where you don't have access to buy them in whole form. For example, our Vietnamese cinnamon, it's this big, thick bark. You will never see that for sale at a grocery store.
Yeah, I'm looking at one of those now. So, I still have one of these that you guys gave me 13 years ago.
But what you get in the grocery store is an Indonesian cinnamon stick. It's very low in volatile oil, and it's probably the bottom rung of the quality of cinnamon. So if you're buying that whole spice with the intent of grinding it fresh yourself, you're still not going to end up with a product nearly as good as buying a ground Vietnamese cassia bark.
Would you do me a favor and just explain the difference? Either one of you. Just jump on that.
It's botanically
one.
Two different trees. They're both in the cinnamomum family, but cinnamomum cassia is a tree, almost looks like a laurel tree, and the bark is harvested from the branches. The tree bark is laid out and dried, and as it dries, it curls up. So when you look at a cinnamon stick, you can see it's one piece of bark curled up, kind of like if you look at a birch bark tree, you know how the birch bark curls up as it comes off the tree.
Yes.
This stuff does the same thing, and it's real long, and then we just run it through saws and we cut it. That's why the ends are straight.
Got it.
God doesn't make the ends straight.
No, okay. you do.
Cinnamomum ceylanicum, which botanically means the cinnamon from Ceylon, which we now call Sri Lanka. Again, same family, cinnamomum, a little different species, grows more like a bush. And they cut the whole bush off about a foot from the ground. And they peel the thin bush bark off the branches. And they'll lay 5 or 6 sheets on top of each other. And then they all curl together. And then they kind of help it roll up together. So when you look at it, you can see many, many layers inside.
And it almost looks like a cigar.
Yes,
that's been kind of loosely rolled.
It's like rolling up a big, long cigar. Okay, so you have cassia bark, which is thick and rolls, you know, as one scroll. And then you have true cinnamon.
Now, the true cinnamon I'm holding right now, kind of a bundle of maybe 6 of these, and it's, 4 feet long? A little over 3 feet long?
Yeah, they measure it in meters.
Okay, it's a meter long. But quite thin and light tan and far more reed-like, I guess, in a way, than the thicker cassia. And it doesn't even really smell like what we think of as cinnamon.
Are you getting citrus notes?
Yes, you get more of citronella kind of Yeah, lemon, well, kumquat warm, in there, yeah. Kind of potpourri smelling in a way. So real cinnamon is something that we could say most Americans have never even experienced.
Right, right. True. Wonderful aroma, but...
Oh, it's fantastic.
But very, very low oil content. Cashew cinnamon, you know, a good cashew cinnamon, let's say you go to Cinnabons and they're bragging about their cinnamon, it's about a 2.5% oil content.
Okay.
The Vietnamese... that you just broke off.
The big yes, sticky
that
bark
stuff
thing.
Runs about 6% volatile oil. The true cinnamon from Sri Lanka is only 1.5% volatile oil. So it's very low oil, and when you grind it up, it's real dusty. And
so why use it? Do people use it very often, or do they, when they want a real cinnamon flavor, they actually go to the cashew instead?
We sell a lot of it. We don't say one's better or worse. Some people like mild coffee. Some people like strong coffee.
Sure.
Some people like light roast. Some people like dark roast. Some people like strong cinnamon. Some people like mild cinnamon. There's a lot to be said for the aroma of this light, true cinnamon.
Oh, I love it.
Yes.
It's very popular in Mexican cooking.
Yes.
So over the last decade, you find more and more people are coming in who understand not only the value of your wares, so to speak, but are starting to understand the differences between all of these things?
We try very hard to educate people, and a lot of it's done by having them taste. So,
but we do. We find far, far more awareness of what's really going on out there, especially with the customers. People are coming in and asking for Spanish paprika, asking for smoked paprika, you know, asking for Ceylon cinnamon.
Does that some of that have to do with the fact that they see these things being used on TV shows?
Yeah,
and,
they see guys
and
like
media
you
and
TV.
Magazines.
And, I mean, you guys set the pace, really.
Yeah, you say sumac is the spice of the year in 2012, and I checked just for fun. And after you said that, our sales increased by 15%.
Seriously?
Sumac. Yeah.
Well, I'm glad I have the... I do not have the corner market sumac. I just happen to really like this stuff. And find that it, I thought it was going to be, you know, the emergent. But didn't Grains of Paradise go up after?
You're like the Grains of Paradise salesman of the universe.
Oh, that was, again, one of those spices that seemed to be so singularly unique. The Grains of Paradise, I remember first getting hold of it and starting to play around with what it could do. And I remember using it in apple pie and thinking that that was really pretty magnificent. That, my cooking has become more spice-centric, I think, over the last decade. My own cooking at home, as I've kind of realized, I've become better with using them as a cook and when I put them in food and how I will build food around certain flavors.
It seems that the better cooks seem to be adding them earlier.
Earlier and fewer.
Yes, and cooking the spices. Cooked spices, for some reason, are far better, for the most part, than raw spices at the end.
I've kind of developed the thought of spices in the beginning, herbs at the end, you know, is kind of what I do. But I was lucky enough to, over the last 10 years, hang out, especially with Indian cooks, who I so admire their use of spice and how, you know, the little collection of whole spices is always at the beginning of the cooking process. And sometimes things are added later on, but it's almost always at the beginning. And I find that the sophistication of those curries and of those dishes really... I don't know, have affected the way that I tend to cook an awful lot. Tell me about some of the other stuff that you brought today.
Well, for us, when we get in new items, we get very excited because we don't think there are that many new things left under the sun to be discovered. But
I would have thought you'd be the last people to think that.
Well, the world is a finite place. So it's a learning experience for us, too. So when we got these Sichuan peppercorns, was it like 10 years ago? I was real excited, and I put it in my pepper grinder, and I put it on a steak on the grill, and it was horrible because I was using it in an application that it was not intended for.
Because you were using it as
that.
Peppercorns.
Right.
Right?
Exactly.
Which it actually isn't.
So, yeah, then the light bulb went off, obviously. It's nothing new.
Why do you even think we call these peppercorns when they're most clearly, absolutely, positively not peppercorns?
Well, why do we call pink peppercorns? I mean, they're not peppercorns either.
I don't know. Why do we?
I think it's great marketing.
Yeah, the French were very smart to name it.
Yeah, you call
most,
it peppercorns and they'll sell. I just think it's lack for lack of a better translation.
They really look like, I mean, they're members of the citrus family, and the way that they look like little eensy beansy, tiny, maybe 16th inch across kumquats almost that have opened up and their inside pulp is gone. So it's just that outer peel, basically.
The botanic botanically, it's a pericarp.
A pericarp. The
There's
outside skin.
There's only a few
skin,
spices
pericarp.
Where the outside is more desirable than the inside.
What are some others?
Staranis.
Staranis.
But again, another way that we're just... People get confused. It's just all so confused.
So you put this on your steak, and that must have been really horrible because
it was
this stuff is not very good when it's heated directly like that.
No, it was just the wrong application. So for us, we're learning about new things too. So we showed this new. We are so excited that we just got this new Sancho pepper from Japan, which is related to Sichuan peppercorns,
but green,
right?
Green is green tea, but it still has the same tingly sensation on the tongue. You call that? You made a reference to that being electrical.
Electrifying.
Yes, like, and that is actually a really, really good descriptor because it reminds me of being a kid and touching my tongue to a 9-volt battery, only not in a bad way, you know, like a little bit of an electrical discharge.
But how is that going to apply to cooking?
And
we have not tested it. We just got this in. So that will be the next phase is we'll go home and all of our staff, they're all culinary geeks and they love to cook. So everyone will go home. Everyone will make things. Some will be disasters. Obviously, you wouldn't put that on steak again. But
as a side note, when it's mixed with other things, you know, in a soup, a small amount in soup, you know, they use the Sichuan peppercorns a lot for it. You know, they'll roast it, grind it up with some salt, mm-hmm. and use that as a seasoning. And in Sichuan cooking, they call it what? Mala?
Mala. You know? Yes.
Yeah, mala. The hot and the numb going together.
The numb.
So paired with other things, you know, this stuff works really good. And you can't really do proper Sichuan cooking without that product. You know, and I would imagine there's going to be Japanese dishes, too, that you can't make properly without this green Sancho. So paired with other things, this stuff is going to work really good.
So
I would imagine there's going to be some roasting involved, too.
I have this bag of this Sancho in my hand, and the pericarps are a little bigger than those of the Sichuan peppercorn, and they're very green in the way that Japanese green tea is green. The citrus and citronella-like aromas are first and secondary.
Yeah, my first word for it was citronella.
Citronella, you know, there's heavy citronella there.
I want to say lemon, but it's more citronella.
There's some verbena-esque stuff going on in there. But then there's something else. And I'm not going to put another one of these in my mouth and chew it because I did before we started recording and realized
away?
That I could not. It did go away. But it scared me for a minute because I have to tell you, you put the Sancho in your mouth and you chew it. It is a much stronger sensation than the numbing sensation of the Sichuan. It is electric in the mouth and it spreads and you can't stop salivating. So I don't think I could actually talk and eat this. But I could see putting this in a soup. Most assuredly.
It does sort of make us think sometimes that America might still be in the infancy stage of compared to some of the other global cuisines out there, like Japanese or Chinese complex that we have a lot to learn and a lot to go forward with.
Yeah, it's funny. You're talking about cultures that have never lost the line of tradition between medicine mm-hmm. and food. We're talking about older cultures. But, you know, I spoke to an anthropologist once who said that America lost that greatly through events like witch trials. Because in European and in early American history, typically the people that got burned at the stake were people that were natural healers who had a great deal of knowledge of herbs.
That's an interesting theory.
And not so much spices because, of course, our climate isn't so conducive to that, but that all of that natural healing knowledge either was suppressed or just flat out wiped out. And there have even been some people that have argued that that in Europe, the church did that somewhat on purpose because of having their hands in the same pocket with the Venetian businessmen who were running the spice trade and wanted to get rid of any kind of competing knowledge bases. But that's suppositional history.
That sounds like a great novel.
It could be.
I think spices as medicine is becoming more in vogue also.
Do people actually come to you strictly for something for a medicinal
We get asked
purpose?
A lot of questions. But
can you give me some samples? I'm really interested in that. It's like what?
I have diabetes. What would be good for that? I mean, people are almost looking for a miracle cure in a spice because that's less frightening than medicine that they don't understand. But we're very careful because we're in this for culinary application. And in most scenarios, near our store, there will be a homeopathic store across the street. And our products cross a little bit. But we take, for example, we take turmeric every morning. My husband grinds fresh turmeric and a little bit of ginger and a little bit of pepper, and we take it as an anti-inflammatory.
Okay. Turmeric's got a long history of being an anti-inflammatory, and a lot of new research just in the last couple of years has come out about turmeric. There's a lot to read. I happen to like a fenugreek a great deal.
That's another interesting and very unused spice, fenugreek.
And it's also very, very medicinal. Very good for us.
Okay, so I walk into my store and say, gee, I need to get some more fenugreek into my life. What do you say to me?
I assume you're doing Indian cooking because that's for the most part the only application. But it's a really nice spice. It almost has a butterscotch flavor to it. It's very hard to describe, but it's very unusual. And it should be integrated into cooking
some more. Some people talk about kind of like popcorn-y. Coming out of that, it's got a lot of complex chemistry
nutty.
In fenugreek, but the nut that comes out of it.
Well, that's why so oftentimes you hear people say, or people talking about medicinal spices, say eat curry, because it's good for you, especially yellow curry. And that's because you've got the big medicinal spices all in curry. Fenugreek, I think, my father-in-law always thought, the guy who taught me about spices, thought that the Indians started adding fenugreek to curry 500 BC at least, not because of its strong flavor, but because they knew its medicinal value. Cinnamon is in yellow curry. Turmeric is in yellow curry. Ginger. Okay, right there. You got four medicines in one dish, and we don't think that those are all added there strictly for their flavor. The flavor of turmeric is not real pleasant. It's a beautiful yellow color, but I don't think it tastes that great. I think.
Careful, sir. Careful.
Easy.
Drink it every day, but we just started drinking it like a shot.
I mean, it's medicine. It's very good for us.
I find turmeric to be more of a punctuation mark on other things. I don't use it by itself.
That's why we think when you're reading that the scientific studies coming out saying that curry powder is so good for you, the main ingredient in curry powder is turmeric, but I think scientists know that most people don't keep a jar of turmeric in their spice cabinet. Unless you've got a really great spice cabinet, but they do keep curry. So they're looking for something that's a common denominator that everybody has.
Of course, everybody I know who cooks Indian cuisine will tell you there's no such thing as curry powder. There's no such thing. We made up curry powder.
It was invented by the Brits.
Invented by the Brits to try to make up for their inability to actually cook curries properly. Now, sitting over by Tom's microphone, we have several bags of brightly colored dark orange. And all paprikas, right? These are all, or paprika, depending on how you say it. Now, this is a spice that even just a decade ago was languishing on most people's shelves. They only thought there was one kind. It did come in the little tin, and it stayed there for 10 years. And then you put it on some goulash, and you called it a day. Now, you've got literally 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You got 6 bags over there. Tell me how that happened, and what do you have there?
Paprika, botanically, is just a chili pepper.
Right.
And a lot of people forget that, And like chili peppers, how many varieties of chili peppers are there? Hundreds.
Maybe thousands.
Yes, and each
ask
region,
Bobby Flay. There's a lot.
So imagine the kinds of paprika there are. 10 years ago,
it's just used for color.
10 years ago, we didn't know about chipotles. That you could toast chili peppers and get a chipotle. Well, if you toast a paprika pod, you get smoked paprika, which is wonderful. They've been doing it in Spain for maybe 100 years, 200 years.
Well, it was a natural byproduct of drying the chilies to begin with.
In parts of Spain and in Mexico where the chilies can't lay in the sun to dry because they'll get rain, they dry them over fire. And in Mexico, you call it chipotle. In Spain, they call it pimentón.
Pimentón.
Yeah, so instead of pimenta or pimento, which is a chili pepper, pimentón would be the smoked version.
The smoked version of it.
Which is incredibly popular right now.
It's great.
One of our best.
Now, what do you attribute that to?
There's a huge seeming renaissance in smoked spices. There's smoked black pepper. There's smoked sea salt. So apparently we crave smoke in some form.
In Spain, they've been making paprika. Columbus brought it back from the New World. So the Spanish were really the first ones in Europe to be growing paprikas, and they're very, very good at it. And people in the U.S. forget about that. We all think of Hungarian paprika or California paprika. The Hungarians, the Ottoman Turks, brought it to Hungary and planted it on the Hungarian plain in the 1500s because the soil was great for growing chilies and the sun was great for it. And then the Hungarians invented a machine to take out the veins and the seeds Remember the cotton gin. What did the cotton gin do?
It took, removed the seeds from inside the cotton fibers.
Exactly. So Eli Whitney invents the cotton gin to take seeds out. And in Hungary, they kind of copied that and made a machine that would take the veins and the seeds out of a chili pepper. The remainder was a real cool red pulpy pepper product that you could dry and grind into a powder, and it wasn't hot because the seeds and the veins were gone. And the Hungarians got famous for making paprika just because they could make it sweet.
Because they figured out the machine. They adapted Eli Whitney's cotton gin.
Right, and they could make it sweet themselves. Because before that, all chili peppers were hot.
Sure.
Nowadays, we can breed paprikas. You know, I mean, chili peppers crossbreed like rabbits. So we can breed the chilies and the paprika pods. We can breed them to be sweet, and we no longer have to take out the veins and the seeds. But back then, that was the only way to make them sweet.
But we have two ratings for chili peppers and paprikas, and one is a color rating, which is called an ASTA rating, which stands for American Spice Trade Association. And then, of course, we have the more commonly known 1 to 10 scale, but in the spice trade, it's Scoville heat units. But the odd thing that we're missing is we don't have any flavor rating. So you're rating chilies on heat, color, but no one has invented a flavor rating. And you know chilies go all over the place for flavors.
Got to have a fruit end, a smoke end, an earth end.
But we do it for wine, so why do we not do it for chili
peppers? Because, I mean, look at the nomenclature and the kind of lexicon that we have around wine, because we're dealing with very, very complex compounds. It's easy to say something's either really, really hot or really, really not too hot, and it's easy to say that it's bright red or it's not so bright, but coming up with all of these other terms, and that's tough because you're dealing with extremely complex chemistry.
So then, again, we're down to the simple taste test.
Got to taste
you're
it.
You're tasting.
I think that with a lot of things, and I think paprika is one of them, cinnamons would certainly be one of them, where you actually need to taste a few. You know, like three. Give me three, and I'll taste them together so that you get some kind of range. I think that's the only way with spices that people can really understand the differences between them.
Right.
And, you know, I order up some smoked paprika. I can say, okay, well, it tastes smoky. But I really don't know until I start comparing it with other things what I'm dealing with.
But then factor in that also it's a crop. So not only do you have the terroir where it comes from, every year it's a different crop.
It's different because it's an agricultural product.
Right. So when I read our catalog about chilies, I usually sit down with a chili and I taste it because it's different than the catalog it wrote last year because it's a different crop.
Sure.
So it's...
Yeah, the heat units are going to change a little from year to year. The same farm, same chili. The heat unit will change year to year depending on the weather.
Does that complicate your business?
Yeah, the problem is trying to make a blend exactly the same throughout the year when the paprika isn't the same throughout the year. You look at any barbecue seasoning or any of the orange blends, when there's dozens of them, you know, that depend on paprika for color and aroma. And they're going to vary as the year goes on because the paprika weakens.
Or sometimes and that's the source just one, dries up.
And that's just one ingredient, you know. Harvest times are important, you know. Certain spices are harvested at different times, you know.
This begs the question, how do you guys store your spices?
Cool and dry. Air is the enemy. Humidity is the enemy.
So you haven't come up with some low atmosphere nitrogen storage system, and I mean
most of this stuff is grown in tropical climates. It's used to being warm, and we're moving enough of it that we're always using the current crop year. We don't have 2010 paprika in the house.
Red spices in general should be kept in the refrigerator, as should seeds.
So not just cool, but the problem is you want cool and dry, and sometimes the refrigerator is the enemy of things that want to be dry, I mean, because of condensation and whatnot. How do you get around that? Do you just suck all the air out of the bag? What do you do?
That's the best thing. Well, you're the scientist. I think...
Oh, sure, blame me.
Now we all have frost-free refrigerators,
yeah.
So it's a lot better than it used to be. Remember, paprika is a chili pepper. So, okay, botanically, it's a berry. So, therefore, berries hold up better in refrigerators.
I think the only spice that we say should not be refrigerated are vanilla beans, because they've gone through a long oxidation process.
Right.
And it's deterred by putting it in the refrigerator.
Well, there's enzymes working in a vanilla bean that develop the flavors. And refrigeration kills that enzyme.
Shuts it down.
Shuts it down.
Yeah.
Vanilla, I'm glad you bring up vanilla because I'm often asked, you know, what's your favorite vanilla? And the more that I try them, the more I'm like, depends. You know, on any given year, I've had Tahitian that tasted like I thought Mexican was supposed to take. I've had Madagascar that I thought tasted. It's very difficult to kind of, at least for me, if I worked with it every day, maybe I'd have this figured out. But I basically come down to whichever the one's easiest for me to get the pulp out of the seed, out of the pod.
We typically recommend we have a Madagascar double strength vanilla extract, and that's sort of our default when people ask what the best is, although we don't like to use the word the best because that's subjective. But I know one year I was baking Christmas cookies and I was so frustrated to find that I didn't have any of that in my cabinet, but I did have some Tahitian vanilla extract, which I just never use because I always think I like the other one better. And I was just blown away by how nice that Tahitian extract was. It was just floral, perfumey, and now I think I might tell you that would be my favorite.
The spice trade attempts to quantify vanilla beans by measuring the amount of vanillin in the beans. Vanillin being the, you know, if you smelled a vanilla bean and you were a wine critic, you would have about 20 words or 20 different...
For vanilla.
For vanilla, right? But it really doesn't... It can't quantify the sensation that hits our tongue.
Describe to me the procurement process of how you get what you need from people. I mean, when you need vanilla, who do you pick up the phone and call? What is the communication like? I'm not saying give away trade secrets, you calling distributors? Are you calling individual growers? I'm just using that one as an example, by the way. Because I'm interested in the relationship.
There'll be
three different guys for vanilla. One of them will be one of the main importers in the U.S. who also makes vanilla extract, sells us beans and extract, and he brings them in directly from Madagascar, Tahiti, Indonesia, etc. The other guy is a brother of the fellow with a farm in Tahiti. So this guy in California calls his brother and says, I need 5 pounds for the spice house. The guy in Tahiti sends the brother 5 pounds in California. He sends us, you know, in Chicago from there. So a lot of times we're dealing pretty close to the farm.
And in Mexico, we know the farmer, and it's actually a woman farmer.
In Mexico, we know the family in Mexico. So we get it right from them.
See, now that would automatically make me want the Mexican stuff more. Because there's an inherent value to the story, to the narrative, of being able to say, look, when we get Tahitian beans, pods, whatever you want to call them, we're dealing with the same international... is the word broker, I guess, correct in this case, then your competition, okay? But then you turn around and you tell me, but when we get the Mexican stuff, we call, you know, the phone rings on a pole at the end of the driveway or whatever, you know, the romance of that vision is, but you're cutting out people, you're cutting out mechanisms between you and the product, and that can be a very, very powerful...
But also, that's the least consistent farmer that we deal with. So that farmer sometimes takes our phone calls, sometimes says that it's in the mail, and then 3 weeks later we go, well, what happened to our Mexican vanilla? So being a small business owner, and we know how this happens, things get, you know, put on the back burner. So it's not a consistent process, whereas with the spice broker, everything goes all the way through the way it should. So, and with the Tahitian farmer, again, if his brother isn't on the farm that day because he's on vacation, there's a big stall. But I guess it's all sort of worth it in the relationship picture.
So is there any spice or version thereof that you can get me that I can't get anywhere else?
Are you talking about black market spices?
No. I don't mean illegal. What I mean simply is that because of your expertise and your relationships, you can get your hands on something that nobody else can get their hands on.
We can get our hands on higher grades than nobody else can. So I'll know how to get the good stuff. And my father-in-law started teaching me that 32 years ago. So anybody can get paprika. Getting the good stuff is very hard. Anybody can get Szechuan peppercorns. Getting the brother of Szechuan peppercorns, beautiful green Sancho, off the plane from Japan is hard. Okay, so...
Most people don't know that there's many grades of saffron.
They don't. Everybody can get you cinnamon. I can get you better grades of cinnamon.
Do you find more and more that people are willing to pay for it?
The funny thing is, the funny thing is, it isn't all that much more.
No, but
talking on a wholesale level, it's about $2 a pound more. Retail level, it comes to maybe 50 cents an ounce.
What is a spice or a family of spices that are selling now that people ask for now, becoming popular now, that 10 years ago you never would have seen coming?
We're selling far, far more cumin and coriander because people are cooking more Indian. People are cooking more Mexican that those spices are being found. Middle Eastern, where cumin is extremely popular. We used to grind 10 pounds of cumin a week. Now we're grinding 100 pounds of cumin a week in one shop. So
my favorite spice, by the way.
Yes, things are moving in that direction. The other big change in what we're seeing cuisine-wise, I mean, you guys set the pace on TV. We kind of grab.
Don't lay that on me. We kind of like lay that on me.
We grab what you guys are showing people and what people are asking for and try and run with it. But smoky flavors, and we talked about it before.
I think one thing that I have not seen coming is the amount of concern about this is almost internally rather than outside cuisines is. People want to know what nutritional components are in spices. They are interested. I mean, I'm constantly getting the GMO question about spices. People want to know, I need a nutritionist or a scientist or a dietitian or someone that knows that kind of information on staff. But when you consider that spices are used mostly for flavoring, it's nominal the amount of, I mean, it's not really a nutritional ingredient, but people are really concerned with
it. I bet you're getting gluten-free issues too.
Gluten-free? It's dying down a little bit. But organic, we tried really hard to launch an organic line about maybe 6-7 years ago, and I was very excited by that. But the problem with organic is a lot of the organic farmers out there are not the same high-quality vendors we deal with already. So in the beginning, organic did not match up with high-quality.
Nope.
And so we would show people, it's like, okay, do you want to taste what we have now and taste organic and tell me that you want to buy organic? And organic is way more expensive. So if you're buying organic at that point, you're sort of buying it for the good of the earth, not for your own personal
good. How can you even, considering that so many of these things come from the other side of the planet, where the same organic certification processes are not in place or enforced, I think it's a marketing word. I've gotten to the point where even in produce, I don't care about organic because I know it's a marketing term.
Very
it doesn't
difficult.
Mean anything.
Very difficult. When you consider peppercorns, which is the most widely used spice, peppercorns are grown on family farms. So you've got a central processor or a guy who gathers it all up, and he'll be dealing with maybe 200 different family farms. They all bring their stuff to him. He mixes the lot together. He bags it up into 50-kilo bags, puts it on a container, and ships it overseas for export. Now, you have issues of traceability. How are you going to trace the origin of that?
Because
in the food business, in the food business, we talk about traceability. How are you going to trace peppercorns? I mean, they're family farms. You're going back to a guy who brought it to another. Right.
Can't be done.
Okay. How are you going to trace or certify organic? This guy might be organic, but his neighbor isn't.
The Asta has made, they're very proactive, and they've made strong efforts to have certification of organic farmers go to a special place where only those farmers go. But on their own, farmers are in third world countries. These are poor people. They're not going to pay extra money for certification for organic.
No.
So
leave the field fallow for 3 years
to. It's not realistic. But anyway, people were not interested in the beginning in organic 5-6 years ago. And then 2 years ago, we're almost ready to let this go. And now it seems the ball is, picking up speed. Now people are more and more wanting organic spices. And the quality has, we found a couple good sources where our organic is.
Well, it's so difficult. It's so difficult in spices because organic in the spice trade means dirty. I mean,
there you go. You
got a lot of bugs on there. You got to imagine the stuff is growing in the third world. It's dried in the sun. What do you think is landing on it? But also, now we're getting more and more sophisticated with cleaning processes, too. We're doing a lot more with steam, where we can pass the product through steam tunnels. And steam is hotter than boiling water.
By a long shot.
Yes. And it will clean up the product. However, that also cooks it, which makes a lot of the volatile oils evaporate off, and you get a much weaker, not as strong spice or herb. Because after you run it through steam, you've got to dry it again too. So now it's been dried twice, it's been cooked, it's been dried again, and it is not as fresh or as flavorful as it used to be.
All right, question. This is from a usability kind of standpoint. Five things you wish people knew about spices and using spices, and they don't.
Air is the enemy. A tight, good container. Plastic bags of spices are no good. A plastic bag of spice gets you home and maybe a week in the drawer. That's about it. Get it in a good container that's airtight.
Like a jar?
Or a can with a tight lid. Or
Tupperware kind of thing.
Tupperware is okay. My mom had little Tupperwares. They were great.
Yeah.
Don't buy more than you anticipate using in 6 months to a year, because that's about the shelf life of a spice. So buy small amounts and buy it more often.
You guys should have like a renewable program where I just place an order and you send me the same stuff every 6 months. So I don't have to reorder.
Don't you like to mix things up a little bit?
Well, yeah, but you know, if I've got on my shelf, I am going to have cumin. I could probably think of, you know, six spices that I cook with on a regular basis. And I wish it was like a magazine renewal where you just sent me new ones every 6 months, so I didn't have to think about it.
You know, most good cooks have a peppermill these days. We should also have a nice one of those electric coffee mills, you know, that we use and use it for spices.
All right, what's another?
I would say think deeply on trends, because I think a lot of things are smoke and mirrors. And with that, I'm mostly referencing the craziness with all the different artisanal sea salts. Sometimes we think it's a little bit demeaning to make a lime salt. So do people really need to buy lime salt? They can zest a lime, mix it with salt, they have a lime salt. If enough people want a lime salt, again, or flavored sugars right now are very popular. But again, a strawberry sugar. Could you make your own strawberry sugar? Do you need to spend $12 for a jar of something that you could make at home for a dollar?
Careful, you're talking crazy again now. Do you happen to sell strawberry sugar?
We do sell strawberry sugar.
And does it cost $12 for a small container?
No, it doesn't. It costs $6. Turkey brining, another example. When brining became big, we said, we're not going to make a turkey brine. That's up to your subjective taste what you're going to put in a turkey brine. But year number one, we held off. Year number two, we held off. Year number three, we made a turkey brining spice. But I mean, think deeper about things that are the current hot ticket in the world of spices and spice blends.
What are some spices that you think that you shake your head that people don't buy and should?
I do like the grains of paradise myself, but he differs on that when he's not so crazy about the grains of paradise. That's still a pretty good one that most people don't have.
And no.
I think the secret for us is it's got a great name. It had a great marketing strategy. When we first started carrying it, was only because there was a beer commercial about it where the man said, I go to exotic places to source things like coriander and grains of paradise for my beer. So everybody started asking for it. And we said, are you brewing beer? No, but it just sounds so fascinating, grains of paradise. And we had this for a couple of years, and we sold it only in its seed form until finally, and we just didn't get it. Finally, someone had a recipe with it in its ground form. We carry everything in seed. We know what happens when you grind it, like Tom said, but it took like a couple years for the light bulb to go off. It's like, oh, well, you have to grind the grains of paradise to really get a good flavor.
Sure.
Although I think in your apple pie, you use it as a seed.
I do.
I think it's unfair to say I don't like grains of paradise. They're,
well, and I like to mix it with black pepper and the pepper shaker.
They're a proven aphrodisiac, so I like them.
That doesn't have the grains of paradise in it.
That's where the name came from. In the 1500s, that's why they gave it the name, grains of paradise. Before that, it was the Portuguese were bringing it in, calling it malagueta pepper.
Of course, back in those days, anything that tasted exotic was probably an aphrodisiac. All right, Tom, what do you think?
I think people should eat more ginger and turmeric. You know, it's just way good for you.
So you're saying that from a health standpoint, not from a culinary standpoint.
You know, I like it in a lot of food too, and I've learned to use it more and more, and I'm eating it more and more because I want to live longer. It's great stuff.
Yeah. Any other spices that we're not eating that we should be?
I like to put vanilla in. I like to cook a pork chop and put
vanilla in savory dishes. Yes.
Vanilla in savory dishes.
Yes.
All right. So you give a pork chop example. Tell me what you do.
I just take maybe a half a vanilla bean, snip it in little pieces. I put a little olive oil, squeeze a little orange juice, black pepper, and saute it. And it's just, I mean, the vanilla has such a sort of a synergistic effect with other flavors that it just seems to enhance just about everything that you put it into.
I mean, one of the things that I like about you making blends for me is I don't like salt in my blends. I want to deal with salt separately. And I know that most people that manufacture and sell spice blends in this country, salt's how you bulk it up. You know, you put salt.
Yep.
And of course, salt's also a desiccant, right? So it helps to.
Oh yeah, in the 50s when my father-in-law started everything or started this business, you start a blend with salt and MSG, and then you add the spices. You know,
that it's was kinda, just the way that they thought
that's
of it.
The way it worked, yes.
So, Tom Petty, thanks very much for coming, being on the show. Appreciate
it. Thank you for
having us. Oh, absolutely.
Thanks, Alden.
We'll see you in 13 years. I realize that the conversation that I had with Tom and Patty, it was a great conversation, but that it might have left some folks feeling a little bit confused about certain spices because we jumped around an awful lot. So I just want to back up and talk over a couple of things just to make sure that we're clear. And I want to start with vanilla, which is one of my favorite flavors. It is so bizarre to me and unjust that in American culture, we refer to anything bland as being vanilla. Because this is one of the most extraordinary flavors and aromas in the world. And look where it comes from. It comes from an orchid, okay? And there are like 20,000 some varieties of orchids. One makes food. One. And it's vanilla. The pollination process is very tricky. The plants either have to be pollinated by hand, or I think there's only one natural pollinator, which is this little type of bee, a stingless bee, in fact, which supposedly can do the job in places where it's native, which, you know, it's just crazy that we would call that ordinary. Now, there are three, of course, it is a cured pod. Okay, now there are three kind of classic, classically accepted growing zones. All right, Tahiti, Mexico, and Madagascar. Now, the varieties that are grown in Mexico and Madagascar are actually the same, botanically speaking. It's a vanilla plantifolia is the variety that are grown there. Now, Mexico, the way they grow them and the way that they cure them, and these are relatively, it's hard to get good quality. There's a lot of bad Mexican ones, to be really honest. When you get the good ones, it's wonderful. They're fat. They're big and fat, and they're oily. And I like them when they're good because they're a lot easier to cut up into strips to put into things because the bean itself is pliant and big and fat. And I like them, but you know what? I do not like vanilla extracts from Mexico because they're usually processed with parts of a different plant, a pod called a tonka bean. It tastes kind of like vanilla, but it actually contains some kind of dangerous carcinogens. So if you see vanilla extract from Mexico, I wouldn't do it. And I would only use the beans or the actual vanilla pods if I got them from someplace really reputable, like the Spice House. And they can have a lot of flavor in them. The Madagascar beans is probably the most famous of the classic varieties. About 70%, I would say, maybe even 75% of the vanilla that's sold in the U.S. is from Madagascar. Technically, the same bean, the same pod as Central America, because they were transplanted there around 1840, that beans were taken from Central America to Madagascar. They're often referred to as, quote, bourbon, end quote, vanilla beans, because Madagascar used to be called the Isle of Bourbon, okay, because it was discovered during the time of the House of Bourbon, which ruled France, went off and on until like 1848 or something like that. So it's got nothing to do with bourbon the beverage, even though bourbon the beverage can certainly have vanilla flavors and vanilla aromas. It is a reference actually to the House of Bourbon, which of course in the long run bourbon is too, but that's completely another show. So that takes care of a great majority of the market. The other one is Tahiti. Now, Tahiti has its actual own variety of vanilla, and it is Vanilla Tahitiensis. Okay, so the first part of that is, you know, vanilla, and the second part basically Tahiti. Very, very delicate looking beans, but they are extraordinarily fragrant. A lot of people think that it's just the cat's meow of vanilla. Personally, I am not as crazy. I mean, I'll take it. But to me, the Tahitian is almost, this is going to sound crazy, it's almost too vanilla. I know that doesn't make any sense. I guess that what I like about Madagascar beans and even certain Mexican beans is they've got some other funk going on there with them. I just find Tahitian beans to be a little one note, but they are very, very, very pure. I run into the same problem with cinnamon. We'll get into that in a little bit. As far as extracts go, because I know most everyone is going to have extracts. I do. I bake with extract all the time. Pure vanilla extract can, by law, contain things like corn sweeteners, caramel coloring. Okay, that is true. But the very, very best ones contain nothing but water, alcohol, and beans. Okay, water and alcohol to extract as much flavor as possible from those beans. And this is definitely something that I would order online. I do not trust vanilla extract from the grocery store. I just don't. Now, the pure, things get kind of tricky here when we're dealing with extracts, because pure single strength vanilla extract contains a minimum, okay, a minimum of 35% alcohol and 13.35 ounces of bean per gallon. Okay, that's by law, all right? Natural, now that's single strength. We can have double strength, and I hear now that they're even triple strength, so those concentrations can change. Most recipes, though, that you're going to encounter are for a single strength vanilla extract, but keep in mind that there are others. Natural vanilla bean flavoring, and that's in quotes, contains real vanilla beans, but no actual alcohol. Okay, the alcohol is actually one of the defining required ingredients there. Thus, it's not really as potent because it hasn't extracted those flavors. And I really don't think of it as being replaceable one part to one part in application. Certainly not in any of my applications. You're going to want to use the pure stuff. Or if you're going to use the flavoring, you're going to have to use a little bit more of it. That's the way I feel. But vanillin in a bottle the actual vanilla flavor may not actually be from vanilla beans at all. It can be from wood pulp, to be quite honest with you, or byproducts of the coal mining industry. So what do I say in the end? Go with the real stuff. Yes, it's 35% alcohol, but keep in mind that's more fragrant because of the lower boiling point of that. So it's more volatile and you get a little bit more flavor out of it. Just a few fun facts. Store vanilla beans inside plastic bags. Suck out as much air as you can and seal them up tight. And then I typically will put those inside something, inside a jar or something that's dark, actually, if I can't keep them in a counter. Once you've used the beans, stick them in some sugar, make vanilla sugar. They've still got a lot of flavor in them, even if you boiled them for a long time. If you're making something like a creme anglaise or an ice cream, you scrape out those beans, the inner pulp, which... I usually do with a spoon, quite frankly. I think it's a lot neater than using a knife. I'll split it and then I'll just scrape it with a spoon so that the pulp ends up in the spoon. But once you use the pods, you can still get a lot of flavor. Park them in a jar with some sugar, leave them for a few months until they're rock hard, and that sugar will be delicious in your coffee. I promise you that. One of the other spices that we talked about that I realized I probably wasn't really clear in setting up very well was what we would call cinnamon. And really the flavor of cinnamon comes from two specific plant barks. One is true cinnamon, which is cinnamon xylanicum. Yes, xylanicum, which is considered to be true cinnamon, also typically marketed as Ceylon. Cinnamon, of course, Sri Lanka, but it's still called Ceylon, even though the name of the country changed. We're talking about longer quills. Of course, that's a roll of bark, but it's an inner bark of that tree, light tan, and it always rolls in just one direction, like a scroll, and it's kind of feathery at the ends. Not the kind of thing that you're used to seeing in cinnamon sticks. It's sweet and a more subtle flavor and aroma, and you can grind that one in a coffee mill. It's loose enough, and it's not as heavy and barky. Most Americans won't ever taste it, and most American recipes are not formulated for it. It's delightful in coffee. It's delightful in baked goods, especially breads. And that is what you will typically have in Mexican hot chocolate, where certainly in Mexico, I found that Mexican cuisine, or Ceylon cinnamon is going to be more often used. Now, cassia. I think probably the most common version of that here. Now, it's got the same first name in Latin, cinnamomum. Okay, so it's cinnamomum aromaticum. It's also called Chinese cassia or just cassia. So the reason that they have the same name is there are a lot of the same chemicals involved, but this is a very different plant. The bark is much heavier. It always rolls inwards towards the outside. So if you look at it, it'll look like it's been rolled in both edges towards the center. Easy way to spot it. It's really, really hard stuff and you can't grind it yourself. Spicy, strong. I keep it around because I like baking with it. It is more like the cinnamon that is called for in most recipes that call for cinnamon, at least if they're American. You can't do it yourself though. It's gotta be ground with what's called a hammer mill. So you're going to want to buy that, on the, on the internet. Cashew varieties, if you really get into this, there are three that I have personal experience with. There's Vietnamese or Saigon cashew, which is my preference. It's got a lot of volatile oils. It tends to be on the expensive side. Really good for cakes and cookies, especially spice cakes. It's what I use in my fruitcake. Complex, sweet, strong. There's an Indonesian version grown on Sumatra. It's actually really complex because it's grown in different grades, A, B, and C, and it's a relatively mild one. I don't really have any purpose or use for it. The most potent of them all is actually the Chinese, or what's called Tonghing cashew, which you could use in, you know, it's really good in cinnamon buns because it is so stinking aromatic, but it's rather one note. It's just like strong, hitting your mouth, atomic fireball type cinnamon. It's interesting to note that for a long time in history, spice merchants made up really, really wacko stories about where cinnamon came from to try to keep people from finding it. Really wacko stories, like it was gathered up by these gigantic birds that would kill you and taken up to their nests, and you had to knock the nests down to get them. Just really amazing stories, all manufactured to keep people from actually finding out where this stuff grew. Fascinating stories. The last spice kind of group that I want to mention and clarify that you heard us discussing a lot of was paprika, or capsicum annuum, I believe. I think that's right. It's a relatively mild chili pepper that is dried, often with smoke, ground, used as a spice. Now, Hungarian paprika is really common. It's actually grown quite a bit here in the United States. Many of them are more, I don't know, pungent than others, but most of them are mild and sun-dried. Now, the Spanish paprika, also called pimentón, that you get in paella at a really good Spanish restaurant. Now, I find this to be, very complex stuff. It is by far, to my mind, the best paprikas, and they come in both the sweet and hot versions, and also, of course, most of the smoked ones that I have experienced, and ones that I have in my cabinet are Spanish. So Hungarian, that's what we used to put in goulash, you know, like 30 years ago, and it's okay. And if you're using Hungarian recipes, or recipes from that part of Central Europe, you might want to hunt down true Hungarian paprika. But for everything else, certainly in rice dishes and chicken, most of the cooking that I do, I'm using strictly Spanish paprika, and I prefer it hot, and I like it smoked. Well, food fans, I think you've had about enough for today. This is Alton Brown signing off for another Alton Brown cast. Thank the Erds from the Spice House for dropping by. Just go to spicehouse.com and order some stuff and keep these fine people in business. They really are the best that I have seen at what they do. So, America, until next time, cook smart.